BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. Now, I'm in Centurion on a rainy Tuesday to talk to Satuma Mohapi, the CEO of the State IT Agency, or CETA, Government Central IT Procurement Agency. Satuma is a former CEO of Centec, who was parachuted into the CETA role back in April 2015. Satuma, thanks for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
There seems to be some stability at CETA now. You've been in the role for 2.5 years. Given that before you joined, CETA had 18 CEOs in 15 years, that must be close to a record already.
It is, actually. I'm the second, my tenure is the second longest already.
Okay.
I passed Mr. Blake in at the end of July. But indeed, there is stability in the bigger scheme of things. The last time we had a situation like this was during the tenure of Mr. Mavuso Msimang. That was way back in the middle 2000s. University just after he left, and then there was quite a lot of turbulence there. And prior to him coming here, he came here to from a turnaround perspective, because there was a lot of turbulence prior to his arrival. So at a minimum, at a board level, between myself and the board, within the executive function, things are quite stable, I think.
Great. There was some confusion when government announced that you'd been appointed as the new head of CETA. Centec said at the time that you remained committed to the company, even after, I think, a cabinet spokesman said that you'd been appointed as the new CEO of CETA. It appeared that the government at the time had jumped the gun a bit about its announcement on your appointment. Were you disappointed to leave Centec, where you'd been running the digital migration project? You seemed to really enjoy the environment at Centec.
Yes, the environment at Centec was very, very exciting. It's a niche area in the broader industry, broadcasting, going through lots and lots of changes at the time. Triggered by the DTT project, but in general, there are other triggers, of course, for changes in the industry with the other methods of delivering content having come through in the intervening years with Netflix and so on and so forth, and Showmax launching. So it was quite exciting. It was also exciting from a point of view of repositioning of a Centec in two ways. One, as a state-owned company that we're trying to make work quite efficiently as a business, using business principles internally and in terms of how we interact with everybody else. But then secondly, just as a general business in a changing industry, running that transformation. So it was quite exciting. I think the transition to CETA, there were quite a number of unfortunate steps there. Obviously, I've previously been involved in an appointment in a SOC position at this level, and one was expecting certain type of things to be done, at least a call perhaps to say that we're taking your name to cabinet and those kind of things. So it was a bit of a surprise when it came out, and I think I got caught, and there was a bit of a stumble on my side and on the side of our own our corporate comms. On the side of the board, the board was quite a surprise as myself. University wanted to manage a number of stakeholders as well as the staff members and, of course, the biggest stakeholders there, which are the customers.
Yes.
Who relied a lot on the leadership that we had put together and the direction that we're taking the organization.
So you must be looking at what's going on in the broadcasting industry with some interest, watching it from the sidelines now, and perhaps some frustration as well to see what's transpired in that digital migration project.
Yes, I mean, I think as a practitioner there, having spent a lot of energy and time on the thinking, a contributor like everybody else into the general issues that were there, I also spending time as an implementer, part implementer of the program, and you know, knowing how much effort we put, how much we pushed our own people, and how much we're trying to pull the rest of the industry. It's quite a pity that we are where we are. Obviously, I'm quite aware of the issues that are coming up in the public domain, but I think it's just a pity for everybody.
Yeah. I could probably spend this entire podcast talking to you about digital migration and broadcasting issues, but that's not why we're here today. Mm. So let's talk about, you arrived at CETA back in early 2015. Mm. What did you find when you arrived here? The general perception certainly has been of an organization plagued in the past by instability, allegations of corruption, and inability to carry out its mandate fully. What were you expecting when you found out you would be taking this job, and what did you find when you actually arrived?
Yes, I mean, I'm like everybody else. I've been an observer. I've been in the industry, so I'm known about CETA from a distance. When I was at Centec, we interacted with CETA at least once, and much as the move from Centec to CETA was quite abrupt, I kind of had a sense of what this organization looks like, and of course, I also shared the general perception that there was quite a bit of an unstable place. Joining in, so there's the 1st of April, the first task was to go to two portfolio committees. The first one was the Telecoms Portfolio Committee to present the annual report, mm-hmm. the annual performance plan. And then the second portfolio committee was where we were called to talk about what had just emerged from the portfolio committee perspective, which was the old issue about certificates for TVET colleges. It was a baptism of fire in a way, because the latter issue probably represented the kind of things that were wrong with the organization, central to the processing of examinations and therefore the issuance of certificates. And it's an organization that is grappling with a problem, but probably two things worry me immediately. One is the real attention to detail. I mean, you're grappling with it, but you can grapple with it in words, but you have to have a feel and a handle, actually, not just a feel, a handle of the real technical operational problems that are making it impossible for us to process this marks for certificates. The second thing is a sense of urgency, that it's the issue affects people who wrote exams as far back as 2007. The issue arises out of certain changes done in 2012 that are retrospective, fine, to 2007, but it's now 2015, and this issue affects people's lives in a very, very critical way, very important way. So there must be a sense of urgency. It is not acceptable to say that we'll solve this problem in 2017, 2018. It has to be sorted out very, very quickly, however difficult the problem may be. So the awareness, I think, of the centrality of CETA in the broader public space, in the broader space in society, and perhaps even the economy, I think that was something that I felt that awareness, critical awareness, is not there. And therefore, the sense of urgency of things that have to be done was probably not there. So that was illustrated by the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training. The second one was now about internal processes. We went, and I mean, this came later on, when we now have to report back on the annual performance plan for the financial year 15-16. I find, as I'm preparing for, first of all, we go to the Portfolio Committee, and the documentation that was submitted there is a bit of a mess. We don't know whether it was one annual performance plan, two performance plans, and the quality is bad. And I mean, I'd worked a lot at Centec in making everything right, whether it's a simple presentation or a full APP or an annual report. And so clearly there's a lack of attention to detail on that. So then I asked, can I be, and the portfolio committee, of course, knew me, for us to be given an opportunity to clean up the whole thing. But then I had to rush because then I was told, no, come a little bit earlier, you don't have a month, you need to come back earlier. So we rushed through it. Later on to find that in the preparation of, remember the annual performance plan would have been done in February prior to my arrival. In the preparation of that, I find errors in the APP. And turns out these errors were more systemic. It was errors in how we budgeted, and we're using formulas, we're not using bottom-up approach, you know, and it was a mess. So, in fact, I knew afterwards that there were the what was being presented to everybody else and what we then subsequently have to present as our performance against our plan is all wrong. So now I have to ask that I have to redo this this whole thing. And it was done, submitted to the board, to the minister, but we didn't submit it to parliament. So by the time we come the next year, of course, then we have to deal with two submissions and became a bit of a mess in doing that. But I think what it illustrated more than the story is weaknesses in certain fundamentals of business administration. If you mess up your financial planning, you're probably going to mess up a lot more things. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of that. So both two things, one internal operations, another one in terms of delivery, good illustrations of the problems that were at hand. And then underline that, of course, then you're saying, why do this problem exist? We operate through people. Then you start realizing about that there are issues that one has to deal with around talent and talent management and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Okay. So how did you deal with these issues? I mean, yeah. In this process of making this, presenting, getting this presentation ready for Parliament, you obviously very quickly got a handle on some of the grave issues that were facing the organization. Yeah. But what have you done subsequent? Yeah. What did you do, say, in the first year that you had?
Let's start with the first year, because the second year then starts looking very, very different. And there are two parts to the first year. The first part is there's two elements. One is a couple of things. One is, you know, understanding people, who are they and who's who in the zoo, where are the capabilities, at least at a leadership level, just increasing the blood pressure a little bit, getting people used to working long hours, working hard, attention to detail. It is not just that you gave me a document, but I'm going to look at everything in that document.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at the numbers. I'm going to look at the source of the numbers. I'll teach you how to look at a simple document and find that it doesn't make sense because you're looking at the boundary conditions and so on and so forth. And then, obviously, during that period, then there are a number of people then who are deciding to leave, which is okay. The environment does not suit everybody all the time. So what I would do is I would meet every week. I would meet with people. I concentrated a lot at my desk. For example, on procurement, if it was not an open tender, I would say, come, it has to come to me. So I remove the delegation on those kinds. Force people to think through why things are not opening on an open basis.
Yeah. Did you have to get rid of problematic people?
I'll come to that just now. Mm-hmm. That's the second part of the first year.
Right.
So there's a lot of attention that we are putting to people. But it became clear that there was an underlying problem, that the organization, from a capability point of view, had a problem, an organizational capability. And one is looking at a number of generations of CETA people, of course, who have gone through a number of changes, a number of experiences. So it is not necessarily a reflection on whether people are good or not. It is a reflection on, based on where they are, is the organization good or not from a human capital point of view? So then, of course, once that's looking at other documents you normally would look at to assess an organization, you look at your other assurance providers, risk reports, internal audit reports, and so on and so forth. And then some themes are coming through. And these are themes that deal with weaknesses in two areas. One is in the HR area, and then the other one is in the SCM area. The HR area, then I process that, and it becomes quite critical, and it looks like an area that one has to deal with first. This is human resource management, not in general. Right? The issues around how we hire people and who comes here, and the issues around how we manage people once they're here, from a general talent management point of view, in terms of training, in terms of managing, I don't want to say promotions, but when a position is available and the way we do interviews and so on and so forth. There are issues around how we manage our employee relations. There are issues around how we manage exits of people, the types of people that exit early and the types of people that don't exit when they should be exiting, and so on and so forth. And then there are some suggestions that the end-to-end process is probably not as clean as it should be, or need some work. So by the second half of the year, we decided to kind of have a deeper look at our ACM environment. Because then I said that for the journey has to start with a strong HCM, human capital management capability, because if that's weak, of course, I won't get anywhere. And if it's strong, it helps me clean up the rest of the organization and helps me, more importantly, build the organization moving forward. So if it's weak, as suggested by the different assurance providers, then we have to start there. Notwithstanding that, of course, there were a number of weaknesses that are being suggested as well in the supply chain environment. So we did a look. When I say a look, I'm being light. It was an investigation, mm-hmm. Into the ACM environment. And we did find things, and we were able to clean, particularly the at a leadership level there. Some people left while we were cleaning, and some people stood up for the hearings, and there were dismissals there. And people have rights, of course. There are still there's challenges here and there that are still going on, but we haven't lost the case anyway, mm-hmm. In any of the forum, CCMA or Labour Court, and that kind of thing. So we're able to clean that. The second thing then, we then paused on creating a new business model, which I'll come to now, just now, later on, that we finished towards the early this calendar year in January. And while we're at it, then we start working through our customers. Obviously, that's a very, very difficult thing, because the experiences with ourselves has been quite tough, mm-hmm. with everybody else. And, you get to a point where it's not enough to make a promise. You need to make a promise while implementing. And in a very, very tough situation with respect to change, showing, providing indications of change is very, very, it's not easy. So how do we do this thing? But anyway, we find, one of the things, a distraction that we need to address once we finish the ACM. ACM took us some time. The next one that we had to deal with was, of course, the SCM, which we started early this
month. That's
supply chain management, yeah. And we kind of put the same process there. The started a bit of last year this time, almost 12 months ago, and then reformalized again in February. That was quite deep, and that's got a lot of stuff there that we found out.
What sort of stuff?
Yeah, it's quite a lot of stuff.
What sort of stuff?
What sort of stuff? Yeah, it's the chain is quite was quite broken, and the supply chain, it is. Obviously we are looking at our supply chain unit, but one is knows that it's a supply chain system. That involves quite a number of people there. But at least that converges in the supply chain unit. The line of business, where the business cases for we want to buy X, Y, and Z, where people, we found things there. People were working with suppliers upfront.
So bribes?
Well, the in the people were compromised. Yes.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest ones is that people were I mean, the interests that people were running here, undeclared interests, oftentimes running their own companies, running their own IT companies within CETA. In a way, competing with CETA, we found those cases, obviously competing with this industry. And people who would be tasked with go and procure laptops for me, and eventually it turns out that the company that would supply these departments with laptops would be owned by the person who is tasked with procuring the laptops. Oftentimes the companies would then be co-owned by a number of people, including the people in. So if you are talking about a bribe, it's businesses that are co-owned
right.
by CETA people and people in the industry. Would find people in departments. And when I find someone in the department, I will go to the department, then my counterpart, and say, look, here is something that is happening in your environment. You deal with it, I'm dealing with my side. So we'd find people owning companies together with the people in the departments there. And we'd find people who spend lots and lots of time, CETA time, who are not working for CETA, working for some other. Obviously, we'd find people who would write business cases that would, as later on, we find that those business cases go to companies where there's association in one way or another, either direct or indirect. So in general, it's what you would call corruption. It's there.
Yeah.
We found it, and we dealt with it quite heavily. And we are not shy. I mean, it cannot say my observation of CETA, observation out there, is that it's troubled because the CETA, there was a lot of people who were compromised inside CETA in one way or another. One cannot dispute that because the reality and the perception are not too far apart. Now, the reality that I know now. And of course, one is in the job not only to clean that, well, you're cleaning it not for the sake of cleaning it per se, but you're cleaning so that CETA can deliver on its mandate properly. And we have to confront that reality, that it has been going on for some time.
It must be quite a difficult and challenging thing to do. I mean, you're going and cleaning up, you're getting in the way of people's vested interests, you're treading on toes.
Yeah.
What was the sort of reaction within the organization as you began this cleanup process?
Yeah, I think the number of them, I think the one that is comforting, because I communicate quite a lot, so I tell people that there are some amongst us here, or where some of them who have departed, that have been busy with things, and I said those are your friends, you used to work with them, and when they leave, don't cry for them. They will go and probably accuse me of being after them. They'll name me names, but I know what I'm doing, and I'm doing it for the right reason. I don't have a hit list of anybody. I tell them that the only people I'm looking for are thieves, people that are stealing public money. So that's that positive reaction then of people who are saying, finally, yes, we have this thing has been happening, but this one seems to be going quite deep. I don't think we have lost as many people. In the past, we have lost the number of people that we have lost in supply chain. About a third of them have left the organization in one way or another, our supply chain people.
A third?
A third of them, yeah. So there's a positive reaction there. There is a reaction of then people who would then create different narratives, maybe in disbelief about the fact that it is happening, and then create narratives that we are targeting people and so on and so forth. Then I don't have time for that thing. And I tell them, if you think that's the case, then give. You won't find proof, but you waste your time trying to find proof that I'm after people. Of course, there would be. I mean, I said to people, if you've been stealing, we will find you. If we find you, we will then discipline you. And if you go through the disciplinary hearing and it's dismissal, we'll fire you. And we don't stop there. We will then take you to the police if it's crime. And we've taken a number of people. We have lots of cases there. We have taken to the Hawks. We have a number of cases, Hawks cases. We submitted them to for blacklisting. So we have companies now that have gone through that process of blacklisting. To the extent that we are required to then inform the Asset Forfeiture Unit for it to do its work, we have done that. We were in conversation with them. University, we were at Skopje last week, where we inform people that if and as we suspect we will be called to Parliament to talk about these things that we are uncovering here, we will not shy away from taking the files to Parliament, because we cannot withhold anything from Parliament. And those files will contain people's names, and people's names will be in the public domain. I don't care. And so that reaction is saying some people will leave and then some people will stay. But of course, it's we have had over the 2 years that we have started this process an unfortunate reaction where then people come after us and then they threaten us with all manner of things. And I tell people openly, I said, I don't care if you kill me. So what, the next CEO?
You've had death threats.
Pardon, yes, we have threats. We have had death threats. If you do that, the next CEO, we have 10. At a principle level, philosophical level, within the system, I'm no longer the only one carrying the message. There is now a critical mass of people here who will carry this sitter through the journey. I'm not the only one anymore. So you are soon going to be the minority, the ones that think that threats will happen. They won't stop us from cleaning the organization. So we continue. I'm cleaning there.
I'd like to ask at this point, I was going to come to a bit later in the interview, but I think it's pertinent now. There was a report on a number of websites. I read the Daily Maverick report, a parliamentary investigation involving the South African Police Service and CETA. Now, I haven't followed this closely at all, but I understand, firstly, the Daily Maverick said you received death threats related to this. It was a contract awarded by SAPS, as I understand it, to a gentleman or a company owned by a gentleman called Keith Keating. Please take us through in some detail what all that was about and why Parliament was involved.
Sure. I mean, first of all, it's not a death threat associated with this per se.
It's not.
I'm just saying that in general, we do get threats.
Okay.
Quite often. I don't answer phones on the weekend from numbers I don't know, for example, because of the stuff that I've been subjected to. So it's not necessarily about that. But and that's number one. Number two is that this COPPA had some questions for SAPS under its normal mandate, and this issue came up about this particular company and a particular contract. The public domain is Rolfin contract, Rolfin. And we were then asked to come and answer questions in relation to that, because CETA was involved somewhat there. The product is bought by SAPS, and CETA facilitates the provision of maintenance service on the product. That's why we were there. But it was our investigation, the SCM, had already covered a number of things in relation to what then we're required to go there with. So it was not difficult for us to come up with the basic information. But obviously we are in the middle of investigating a number of things there. So we don't have, at the time, we didn't have enough information to cover the entire relationship between this company or its directors and the rest of CETA. That's number two. Then what happened is that we picked some things up. And one of the people that left in their charge sheet, I know it's charge sheet number 7, was actually charging them on the procurement process in relation to exactly what Skopje was asking about, Rolfin. And that person decided to leave. But we're definitely following on that issue to the extent that there are suggestions of criminality there. But because he left, then we could not finish that investigation on time. I mean, we didn't have enough information there. But I must confirm that it was one of the charges facing the employee. Then it was after GovTech. Prior to GovTech, actually, We then, another risk came up in another area, and then I initiated an investigation around one other person. And then after GovTech, then there were confessions from that person, which then raised a big red flag, which then required us that prior to, we had already awarded something on the back of, yes, it's we kind of don't have a choice now because the business case has come to me quite late, even though we're trying to solve that problem. But we don't have a choice for the purpose of service continuity. But it gives us, we accept this thing for the purpose of giving us the opportunity then to review the entire thing. We also decided that process with the same company in the previous financial year. But this red flag then says that you have to be careful in contracting with this company. So by the time we go to Scopa, we have awarded but not contracted on another service with this company there. So when we're at Scopa, of course, we are providing that information, and it is the first time that this information that we had that was already available to other people who had asked us. I mean, as you just confirmed there, that IP had already asked us for some of the information there. Was in the public domain. And that's how it came out. And it's probably, I mean, the question that for us is, was that the right way for it to come out in the public domain? Probably not. We're in the middle of an investigation, but it is in the public domain. We don't have anything to hide. We are trying to do the right thing with an acknowledgement that there is a lot of work that needs to be done. And we confirmed to Parliament that we were not asked by any organ of state other than our own governance structures to initiate these investigations. And we'll absolutely comply and work with people as both the leadership in SAPS and also anywhere else in cleaning up that thing for the rest of the country. I mean, what we are doing, we are not, our investigations are targeted specifically at our own operations and our own employees. And if we find, as we have done in other places, our suggestions of involvement in the departments, we take the information to our counterparts.
Okay. Yeah. So you've been very busy here cleaning up a lot of mess by the sounds of it. Yeah. How far are you down that process? Is there still a lot of rot here inside CETA that you need to clean out, or are you a long way down that path, or are you actually finished it at this stage?
No, we're not finished. Let me start there. I mean, the support we got, and we appreciate that support. I mean, Scopa is a very, very robust committee. And I think we came out of there, there was a lot of support that we got, an appreciation of the task at hand. And I do recall that we were encouraged to complete as quickly as possible, but don't stop until we have reduced the risk sufficiently low enough that CETA, the word corruption and CETA are not set in the same sentence. It's more CETA is an example of how to clean up this kind of environment. So we have the support from Scopa appropriately, and we'll continue doing so. I think the most important thing is that we are creating, in stark terms, we are creating awareness within the organization quite openly, and that it is here, this stuff, and we are cleaning it, we are leading from the front, and we will continue cleaning it as soon and as long as it's here. So in a process of change, you have the capturing the hearts of people is probably the most important part, because then the minds follow fairly quickly afterwards. And we're talking about that that inertia. The car is a bit static, and you need to put a lot of energy to get it moving. But once it starts moving, then it kind of works on its own momentum. And I think we are at a point where I can say the car has started moving. As I said earlier, that even the ones that say that they can threaten me, there's far too many people now who are driving this car with me together. Yeah, so we are moving along, and I'm quite happy with the awareness, and also the fact that there's more people driving this thing. But there's still work. Do we find people? Yesterday we fired somebody. on Friday, I'm informed by that there are more people that were found that were not there 2 weeks earlier. I meet with the investigators every 2 weeks. So things are still popping up.
Let's move on a bit. You spoke about a new business model for CETA, or a new CETA.
Yeah.
Take us through what you mean by that.
Absolutely. And these things and it's a very, very important part of the story, Duncan, because, you know, the creators of CETA were not wrong. There are CETAs around the world. I always say that the first TCPIP network of networks was run by the Defense Advanced Research Program Agency of the U.S. Department of Defense, obviously working with the academia in the U.S. and the industry. And that's a government agency, driving innovation and bequeathing quite a lot, not only to the economy of the U.S., but to the world. And I think the creators of CETA were probably influenced by such ambitions to create a competent agency that would use government to drive innovation and those kind of things. Of course, sometimes we kind of say that's a bit of an oxymoron. Government and innovation don't talk about them in the same breath, right? But there are examples of that. The innovations and progress in technology, a lot of it will come from the space agencies and the work that is done there, run by whether the European Space Agency or NASA, and that kind of things. And what did we have? What do we have? Perhaps there's a lot of innovation that would have come, again, out of government doing work in different contexts. There. So I think the creators of CETA were right. It feels right when you read why this thing was created. But I'm the first person to say, if one looks at CETA right now, if the mandate in law is improve service delivery to the public using IT. So we are public servants, number one. Our contribution is using IT to improve service delivery. Everybody else knows that technology drives changes in society, improves lives, everybody else. So CETA is supposed to use technology to improve public life. First, improve the administration in government, public service, improve the public services that are delivered by government, and then through improve how society indirectly then benefits in general. Can we find in CETA some performance metrics, anything that talks to quality of education, improvements in quality of education using technology, improvements in quality of healthcare using technology, improvements in the output, in agricultural output, mining, ease of, I mean, if I'm a new entrant in mining, how can I use technology, to de-risk my entry into the system? No, we can't. We don't find that in terms of metrics or performance metrics. And therefore, you won't find activities within CETA that try to deliver better public services using technology, right? And therefore, you wouldn't be surprised, therefore, that CETA probably has not delivered on its original mandate. Because, in fact, what you'll find as my performance metrics would be how, whether or not the IT operations work well. And that's a conversation that happens then between CETA and government departments. It's about uptime of networks. It's about hosting uptime, and so on and so forth. It's not about the quality of the applications there. So, and as a result of that, we have built an organization that's very, very operational, and therefore that is equipped with operational people and generally people then who maintain the status quo. So we look at the distribution of human resources. Way more than two-thirds of them, almost three-quarters of our human resources are maintaining things. Either maintaining the enterprise environment in government offices and maintaining the applications that are very, very old, or maintaining networks in the same way that we built them probably 12 years ago, and so on and so forth. And where we could be doing new things, for example, in application development, very, very few, but in fact less than just over 5%, 5.3% of our employees are involved in things, in application development, in standards, and IT security. That's where there's always dynamism in the space. So less than 10% of our funds are deployed in those areas where there could be growth in general, and certainly introduction of new things. So it was always our operations. So we're saying to ourselves, of course, that's not sustainable. Our business model then changes. It challenges us to be creators of value at a point in time, to use different performance metrics, to use public service performance metrics. And then IT metrics will measure our low-level technical staff members in terms of IT. But my performance metrics have to be similar to the performance metrics that are used by people in the business owners in departments, and not necessarily even the IT officers in departments. Then we're saying that, okay, fine, if that's the case, then I work through a structure. The structure then, or the face of CETA in front of customers, then has to carry the same performance metrics, right? So it cannot be whether or not we have invoiced well, whether or not the SLAs, service level agreements are done, whether we have meetings. Those are still required, but that's not the face of CETA. In fact, the face of CETA should be a consulting face, because a consultant by nature is always probing. A consultant by nature always sees problems. Alternatively, a consultant by nature always sees an opportunity for improvement. And a consultant by nature, so there's two different kind of consultancies. The driver, the first one, then is business consultant, where we can go, you know, we start the loop of IT consulting and then doing the IT work. By going into government and looking at a cluster, for example, a cluster of government, social cluster, and trying to figure out what, and understanding the problems that this cluster is dealing with. We can do the process work in there. We can do linkages between the ask questions about the effectiveness of the processes within departments and between departments in the promises that government has made to people, whether through the NDP or the MTSF or the MTF or within the annual performance plans, right? Because that has to be tested as well. And we can use certain IT skills that are used in IT development, but on the business side, to assist departments in doing so. Then we do the process work. We can do solution design at a higher level to say, given if we were, so we do business design first. What are the outcomes that we want? How would we, in the short term, in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, NDP world, design new systems within the social cluster? We do the business design together. And we do so with putting half of our minds, obviously thinking with an IT hat on. That's what consultants do all the time, right? And then we do the solution design. And that becomes a blueprint for the IT world. That's when we go into the industry and say, this is our plan for transforming government operations using IT over the next 5 years. Prepare yourself, industry. So the second thing that happens, therefore, after we transform, we change the face of CETA to consulting. We then change the rules of engagement with the industry. Please don't talk to us. If you want to be a box dropper, it's fine. Wait at the end. Wait for a tender, right? We'll publish a tender. But if you want to start working with us in creating solutions, business solutions to government business problems, then prepare yourself for this world. Prepare yourself for these solutions.
I presume that this is going to require quite a radical new mindset for the people inside CETA.
And outside.
Yeah. And may require a different type of skill.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that particular issue? Do you retrain people to become more consulting focused? Yeah. Do you hire new people with a fresh approach?
Yeah.
How are you doing it?
So it will be a mix of things.
Yeah.
One is, even in the consulting space, we're not going to crowd out the consulting firms there, but we're going to have a more meaningful relationship with the consulting firms. So we'll make use of the consulting capabilities there. But we have to have our own consultant. Then the typical consultant will, you're absolutely right, it's a different skill set. And remember, we're just talking about just the customer-facing side of it. It's a different skill set. We have to bring new people, new leadership at a particular leadership level. It has to be people with a mindset so that they can drive change appropriately. And we need to give our people an opportunity to change. I always say that it's It's change, not training. Training comes after. The first change should be you need to be a slightly differently inspired person. I cannot train you to be, I can train you to be an observer of the world, but eventually you have to be inspired to be an observer. If you cannot analyze the world and observe the world and feel the world, you cannot be a consultant. So are there people in here who, as I talk to them, come up and say, you know what, I've been thinking about this, I've been thinking about that, in GIS, in all manner of things, driver's license, how we can cut the queues by one-tenth of the time instead of 5 hours, maximum 1 hour, that kind of thing. Are there people who have been thinking about those things? Yes. We have tested a number of things. Last year, we said, let's do a hackathon. We're going to do a hackathon. So we asked people to go for the holidays and observe the world and come back and tell us what public policy issues do they see. They don't think too hard. Think about your own environment that you experience. How would you solve that problem from a business perspective? And how would you use IT then to implement the solution? And we said it's open to everybody. So people came. I think they didn't know we're doing an experiment. Actually, quite a number of people came, and IT, non-IT, business, and so on and so forth, and people in different parts of the organization. Then we told them, okay, fine, we're going to train you on business value proposition creation. And we brought people here to train them. And then we said, fine, we put them in different groups. We are going to have a proper hackathon. Mm-hmm. Then we trained them on coding and so on and so forth. Then we had a proper hackathon. You should have seen the things that they did there. Actually, we offer every one of the people that joined that hackathon, we offer them a position in our e-government department. And they're thriving. They are absolutely thriving. So the opportunity is there for people, but it has to be a mix of people. But it's a big change. I mean, I must also confess that every time I state this story, especially to the external world, they look at me and there's that grin that pops up that says, yeah, right. we'll see it when it happens.
Yeah,
but the shoots are there.
Okay,
I'm starting to show. Yeah.
So, according to press reports back in July, the Telecommunications and Postal Services Minister Siyabonga Kwele, who has oversight of CETA, was highly critical of the organisation. One report that I read said that government may even be questioning CETA's relevance after, and I'm quoting here, failing to deliver on its mandate. Kwele reportedly said that CETA had failed to implement a national e-governance strategy and roadmap, missing a 31 March deadline to do so. Is that criticism fair, and what was the genesis of it?
Well, the first part is that the general statement that CETA has, over the period, I mean, one has to look at from its creation to now, and the promise of CETA, and whether or not it has delivered against that original promise. I think anybody who says yes would have to argue very, very hard why they say so, right? That's number one. Mm-hmm. So I think that is, then the minister was stating a problem statement that is then saying in this on the second part that he has instructed us to then address that traditional problem of CETA and the traditional problem of not having addressed the mandate there. So that conversation we would have had with the minister around the importance of us doing things that are fundamentally different with this board and in this executive to what has been done in the past. And I think from my side, it is also, I'm a very open person, and this seat, of course, belongs to the state. It belongs to everybody. And saying the minister having said it to us and saying it up front is a statement that we must accept, because it is a problem statement that we are faced as new leadership here, and we must address, and we must be clear to everybody that we are transparent about that and we are facing those problems head on. There's nothing worse, of course, than not stating it, and eventually you will believe that you don't have a problem. Mm-hmm. But of course, you don't dwell on a problem all the time. You must then be focused on the solution. Hence, that kind of industry day that we're having there. Then the second part of that was the e-strategy. I think that was more towards the department. The e-strategy, which was then gazetted, passed through cabinet, is a deliverable of the department, not of CETA. So perhaps what the minister was talking about would have been the support. I don't know. I mean, it was more the department. The deadline belongs to the department. To the extent that the documents were late, then perhaps the suggestion is that we are also late in implementing, because we're being set up there as an implementing agency from an IT perspective. We had done a lot of work, preparatory work. We started an eGov program a year before in CETA, and now I've converted into a new application development department that's fully fledged department incorporating the eGov program. In fact, we had already done some work there. Perhaps it was not visible yet, but we have launched a number of things that hadn't been launched. I mean, at least with the speed that we have launched the things up to now. So I think it was a moment in time, and perhaps a moment of transition from a past into a future that we're quite in control of, at least from a delivery point of view now.
Okay. Yeah. Wanted to ask a bit, maybe I should have asked this a bit earlier in the interview, but just maybe if you don't mind, give us some idea of the size of CETA. You publish an annual report, obviously, every year in which your financials are detailed, but maybe give us some idea of the amount of procurement spend that gets routed through this organization, and also the size of the organization, how many people it employs.
So we start with the people, about just over 3,000, about maybe, so the number is kind of dropping in transition. So 3,100 or so employees who are throughout the country. We have offices in each province. And from an operations point of view, if one was to look at the turnover as another sign of the size of the operation, it's about just over 6 billion turnover. Of that, about a third of that is procurement transactions that we do. On our income statement, that's about so it's about 2 billion, right, of that is procurement. Which obviously, I think it's quite important to talk about the in our business model what we are doing with procurement, because we're doing quite a heavy surgery there. I think as you're introducing us, you said that we are the IT procurement agency of CETA.
Yeah.
Which if you look at the finances, obviously 1/3 of the finances talk to procurement, but if you look at the mandate and the original promise of performance, it should never be that way. We should never be seen as a procurement agency of government. We are a consultant to government on how, and also an operator and an ensurer of implementation of interventions that bring improvements in public service delivery using technology, and in particular information technology. And so that's why I was saying, this business model is pivoting away from being seen and acting as a procurement agent to acting as a driver of change and acting as a better user of IT and innovator. So procurement, therefore, then has to change. So we spend a lot of time doing transactions, right? I mean, you want to buy something, you transact, we transact, and it's manual transactions. So the first thing, we're doing a couple of transformations, a couple of ways there. The first thing is automating the whole thing, such that there is nothing that you will buy, certainly off CETA, that is not done through an automation. And the scale and the type of automation is what you see in e-commerce platforms. Right? But in addition to e-commerce from a buying perspective, so we have a buy side that looks like the normal buying. But remember, behind a typical e-commerce platform, is also a supply chain system. Because when I order that thing on whatever .co.coza or .com, sometimes it's not even made yet. And that order triggers a supply chain system that then creates, that goes into, even into manufacturing. Right? So there's always a supply chain system there. So supply chain, the sourcing module and contract management module are part of our automation process. Right? It's a massive game changer for us. Because once we have done that, then we put all the controls that CETA is accountable for purchasing IT on behalf of government. We put them into the system there. right? Then we can start asking and saying, look, Minister, Mama Minister, why then, once we put the controls there, why don't we devolve the responsibility for transacting to the departments or to the users? Within CETA, it is to the line of business. Outside of CETA, it's to the departments. These are the transactions. Why should I have people employed in CETA procurement who now are just clicking and clicking and clicking and processing an order? Right? There's no value added there. There's no thinking anymore that is happening. Mm-hmm. So that's the first part. So it's automating. And then we spend most of our work then doing, so tactical sourcing, then we say, why are we doing tactical? So tactical sourcing is a typical tender that takes a long time and causes all sorts of problems. We are now remain with two types of sourcing operations, commodity sourcing and strategic sourcing. Commodity sourcing is very, very easy to deal with because we go do framework agreements on the commodities, we put them into the automation system, prices is there. Sourcing then happens on a competitive basis on the system itself, and that sourcing then happens, is done by the departments or the users. Strategic sourcing, we turn it into a consulting system because you are creating a solution and you are going into the market on a tender for a solution. So you spend more time designing the solution and less time trying to design a tender spec, right? So by the time we do the tendering, the design is work is done, and the tendering can actually be done again through the system by the consuming department there. Where we now spend time is doing the smart part of supply chain, right? The operations research side, is doing smart demand management. Static demand, we do it, we consolidate properly. We do then dynamic demand. Dynamic demand could be cyclical demand, or we allow for even unpredictable demand, emergency demand, using your typical elastic supply chain system that are typically there in a cloud environment, right? Then we do also do smart supplier management, supply intelligence management. I must know each and every how each and every OEM works around the world. So it's a commercial exercise. The people that are in my supply chain are now commercial people as opposed to administrators of tenders. That's huge surgery. Of course, the numbers in our supply chain, the numbers change quite drastically. We've told our people that in the benchmark on the supply chain, it's not 84 people as we have now, or 124, 148 that I was being asked to hire. It's actually less than, it's about 10, no more than 20, certainly. Mm. That's the benchmark for the number of people in supply chain. Now, the question, of course, is the skill set required there is also fundamentally different to what we are employing right now. Our challenge to our people, of course, is that they know these numbers. They know the number from 84 to 10. In fact, when I describe supply chain, and then I ask each and every staff member, so if I started with 84 people, and now our supply chain system looks like this, right? How many people do you think we need? I've never had a number greater than 20 volunteered by CETA people. So they get it. Yeah.
As we move to wrap up, Satuma, mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you a bit about cloud computing.
Yes, yes.
The nature of the IT industry is changing quite significantly, especially with the emergence of cloud. How is that changing cloud specifically? How is it changing the way CETA works? How do you approach cloud? And is there an opportunity for this organization to build a government cloud? Or would you simply work with existing cloud providers in the private sector?
Number one, so last year I started three programs. One was eGov, and it has resulted in us creating an application development capability where we're working with the industry. It's quite relevant to the cloud story as well. The other one was what we call government e-commerce, which is G-commerce. I just talked about it now. The third program was cloud, we call it. Cloud now, we have integrated cloud with our hosting business. And in fact, our hosting, and we're, every one of these programs is now driving modernization of a critical part of CETA. So the first thing is how important it is as a construct, it is underpins the modernization of actually how we provide services, because whether it is compute or storage, infrastructure as a service or platform as a service, the one of the primary promise of performance, value proposition for cloud, is flexibility and dynamic demand management and so on and so forth, and self-service for compute. But the question is, why should we not have apply that construct for all services that we provide to government and create that level of flexibility? So that's the concept. We're using that concept quite broadly. When it comes to hosting and our platform area, then we are using the cloud construct as the framework for modernizing our hosting environment in a big way. So the concept is, and you're asking then, so it's everything we're doing. It underpins everything. Then our concept is a government private cloud ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So because if I say cloud alone, I scare people because the typical person thinks cloud, whoa, where is this stuff? You know, it could be anywhere. And we're talking about a public cloud. But we have lots and lots of information here that must not sit in a public cloud. So, but it's the cloud in the government private cloud ecosystem talks about the construct for modernizing your hosting environment around compute and storage and software access and so on and so forth. Then it's private because it creates, even if some of the functions are provided through outside of CETA, are provided even, let's say, in a private cloud kind of setting, we have guarantees of privacy there. And we only take things into kind of that setting if we have the guarantees of privacy, and very, very few of them, and where it does not make business sense to keep them in a private setting on premises on a government data center. So privacy is privacy in terms of deployments and privacy in terms of control. Then it's government because it then holds government our workloads. Right? Then it's an ecosystem because the deployment methods then can find themselves, we can deploy the infrastructure can be deployed in different, first of all, geographically, it could be in different geographies, it could be in different locations within a geography, it could be in a public data center where it's caged and so on and so forth, or it could be on an infrastructure where we share some of the infrastructure, but we have enough privacy and we have privacy on platforms and applications, certain applications there. So it's an ecosystem. It's everything. It's an exciting project for all of us. Obviously, the promises are all there. The promises of our flexibility, the promise of agility, go to market much faster, allowing us now, as we increase our funnel of applications, we are now, in terms of application development, we are going custom software development. We have invited people, that at least the initial group is 53 companies that have subscribed to us for custom application development. So we're going to increase, scale that thing up very, very big time. Where is this thing going to sit? If we're going to host this this new load of applications using the current hosting environment, we'll be bankrupt tomorrow. So we increase the space, but it's also much more cost effective. But we're also inviting government as well to change, kind of adapt business models. What one has seen coming here is the for whatever reason, government departments choosing to then buy their own hosting environment and sit up providing housing, so to speak, almost an open data center. And government departments put their own server environment. Obviously, that kind of goes against the grain. And it uses government capex money quite a lot. And by the time I finish buying that infrastructure there, I'm probably only getting the benefit of 10% of it, 20% of it. So there's a promise now of converting how we spend money on hosting away from capex to opex and doing so much, much faster and with much more agility. So it will bring a lot of benefit to government. Yeah.
Great. There's probably tons and tons more we can talk about, Satuma. Yeah. There's so many angles to this. We could talk about the transversal systems. We could talk about IT management within government departments, etc. But I am conscious of time, so I think we should probably wrap it up there. It's been a wide-ranging and a very interesting discussion, so thank you so much for your time on the Tech Central podcast today. Satuma Mohapi is CEO of the State IT Agency. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Duncan.